Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What I am certain of is that Israeli decision makers and Israelis themselves aren't going to view over 300 missiles and drones all across Israel as a proportionate response to a single strike in Damascus.
The Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate, not only was it an escalation, it was a way of goading the U.S. into a wider regional war.
You have this just groundswell of opinion right now, overwhelming, that says the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, can no longer get away with getting subsidies for yeshivot, for religious schools, and tax breaks and services, unless they're going to serve in some way.
You cannot bomb and eradicate an idea by military means, that ultimately what they're doing in Gaza is recruiting more soldiers, ideological and physical soldiers, for Hamas.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, right.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
The United Kingdom is a great country.
Never, never been a good bet to bet against America.
Hello and welcome. On this episode of Mid-Atlantic, where I, Royfield Brown, is sat in Birmingham in England, we're going to explore Middle Eastern geopolitics. And we're joined today by our friend of the podcast, Michael Kaplow of the Israel Policy Forum in Washington, D.C. So we're going to discuss the recent turmoil in the region, Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria, and Iran's missile response, which happened over the weekend. We're going to examine the global reaction and strategic consequences, highlighting the impact of Iran's strikes and the international calls on Israel for restraint. Our discussion also covers Israel's contentious new military service plan, which has sparked debate and calls for the ultra-Orthodox community to end its draft exemptions.
This takes things to an absolutely new level. It does appear that this was a strike by aircraft, which means effectively that it could only have been Israel that was involved, but there seems to be little doubt about it. So they have struck against the consulate of Iran, which is right next door to Iran's embassy as well. You know, it is almost, and this is the way that the Iranians seem to be interpreting it, an act of war against Iran. It goes against all diplomatic conventions. And they have threatened that they will strike back harshly, to use the words of the ambassador. We also know that the deputy commander of Mr. Zahedi was also killed, and also the commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria and Iran. So these were very serious and senior people.
Michael, welcome back to the show. I think you're only on about a couple of weeks ago, but it feels like a whole load of things have happened since. How devil are you, sir?
So thanks for having me back. And things always happen quickly in this region and in enormous volume. Yeah, I think a lot of things have happened since we last spoke a couple of weeks ago. And I've been trying to keep on top of everything as best as I can.
Let's go to the most immediate crisis, which is the Iranian missile attack on Israel. Now, obviously, that was in response to Israel bombing the Iranian consulate in Syria. How was Iran supposed to react to such an attack which, in terms of international law, is an attack on Iranian territory.
In international law, an attack on a country's embassy or consulate is considered a grave violation. Under the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations of 1961, the premises of embassies and consulates are inviolable and protected from entry by the host country's forces without consent. Such attacks are treated as assaults on the sovereign territory of the nation the diplomatic missions represent, equating to an act of aggression against that nation. This can lead to severe diplomatic repercussions and may justify retaliatory measures against the host country or the aggressor state, including actions against their diplomatic missions.
So the Iranian response to Israel on Sunday morning, where shot over 300 ballistic and cruise missiles and drones at Israel, was, as you point out, nominally in response to the Israeli attack on April 1st on an Iranian facility in Damascus. There's a debate taking place between the Israeli government and others where Iran says this was a consular building next to its embassy, and Israel says that this was an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps headquarters. And the IRGC, I should note, is a terrorist organization, at least according to the United States. So there's a debate about whether this was truly a diplomatic facility or not, but let's assume for the purposes of the conversation that it was. So you are correct that Iran has taken this as an attack on its own territory. But it isn't just about the Israeli strike on the Iranian facility. There's this shadow war that's been going on between Israel and Iran now for years. And in many ways, it really ramped up with the Syrian civil war, where for the first time you had IRGC and Iranian forces in Syria in a major way. And they were involved in attacks on Israeli positions across the Golan Heights and also involved in transiting weapons across Syria into Lebanon for Hezbollah. So you've had this tit-for-tat back and forth between Israel and Iran now for years. Israel's calculus was that striking this facility in Damascus wouldn't precipitate a huge Iranian response because it was a limited strike. That, of course, turned out to be incorrect because Iran did indeed respond with over 300 missiles and drones. And so your question is, how should Iran have responded? I think that actually the question before that, and it's still an open question as far as I'm concerned, is whether Iran was trying to respond to Israel in a way that signaled it was responding in force, but that was designed not to escalate things. In other words, did Iran know that the various missiles and drones that it sent toward Israel would be easily intercepted? And there was this strange moment for Israelis on Saturday night where they had notification that drones were launched, but it takes 5 to 6 hours for the drones to get from Iran to Israel. And so people were literally just waiting for hours for these things to arrive. Or did Iran actually intend to cause real damage? And I think that there's evidence for both sides. As I said, on the one hand, this was very telegraphed. For days, Iran was talking about retaliating, and then it sent a bunch of things that are pretty slow moving and easily tracked. On the other hand, it also sent a large number of ballistic missiles, which take 10 to 12 minutes to get from Iran to Israel. And there's evidence that because those were all aimed at Israeli Air Force bases in southern Israel, that Iran may have been hoping that Israel would be distracted by the cruise missiles and the drones, and that the ballistic missiles would get through and strike Israel's F-35 fleet and the Nevatim Air Force Base in the south. So it's an open question, and I think that also then goes to the question of what should Iran have done? If it's the latter, if they intended to actually strike these Air Force bases inside of Israel, unquestionably that would be seen by Israel as an immediate and serious further escalation. And if they intended to shoot a bunch of things that were easily intercepted, then that indicates that maybe they viewed this actually as proportional and were trying to de-escalate. And I'm not sure that we know or have a good answer. What I am certain of is that Israeli decision makers and Israelis themselves, whatever Iran's intentions were, aren't going to view over 300 missiles and drones all across Israel, southern Israel, northern Israel, Jerusalem, as a proportionate response to a single strike in Damascus. So I will be very surprised if there isn't some sort of Israeli response. I think the question is what that response is going to be and whether Israel is now going to look to respond in what they view as a proportionate but de-escalatory way, or whether Israel is going to take the opportunity to really strike at Iran in a much more forceful manner.
And James, this is an attack that Israel has been expecting for several days now.
Yeah, that's right, Ben. Ever since that attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria, there's been growing speculation that Iran will have to respond in some way. There's been talk about different types of attack, but it now appears that attack is underway. Military spokesmen here in Israel say that drones have now been launched from Iran. They are directed towards Israel. There have been reports from Iraq of many drones being seen in the sky. Earlier today, just before this attack was formally confirmed, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave an address to the nation saying that his country would overcome all its enemies.
Israeli citizens, in recent years and even more so in recent weeks, Israel has been preparing for the possibility of a direct attack from Iran. Our defense systems are deployed. We are prepared for any scenario, both in defense and attack. The state of Israel is strong, the IDF is strong, and the public is strong.
And in a statement, the supreme leader in Iran, Ali Khamenei, said, and I quote, "The malicious Zionist regime," that's his name for Israel, "will be punished for what he called an attack on Iranian soil." In other words, the attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria.
The Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate or facility, don't get into the semantics of it, surely was the escalation. And not only was it an escalation, it was a way of goading the US into a wider regional war, and that this is much more political than it is military and strategic.
No question that there's a good argument to be made that this was an escalation, again, given that it was on a facility that Iran claims as a diplomatic facility, and that it did kill a high-ranking Iranian general and a number of other high-ranking Iranian officers. But I don't think that the Israeli government intended for this to be something that would draw the United States into a wider war with Iran. First of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu and other ministers in the government know full well that the U.S. has very little appetite for getting involved in a war with Iran. And this also came amidst a real period of tensions between the U.S. and Israel. So the notion that Israel would do this and then the U.S. would get involved in a wider way, I think would have been a difficult argument to make. And we can say lots of things about Israeli leaders, but they're not dumb. I don't think it was political in that sense. And I think that I also think that, as I said, Israel.
Just on that though, Michael, just because the timing does feel incredibly political. Well, we talked about this before, but the International Court of Public Opinion is most definitely going against Israel regarding its onslaught in Gaza. There is no equivocation about that. And that this has the potential to at least remind people that Israel has an implacable enemy, Iran, in the region. And most of the world is not pro the Ayatollah's regime. The timing does seem somewhat fortuitous. And whether this is going to suck the US and other Israeli allies into a war, British warplanes, the British Prime Minister has said, were over the skies of Israel and Jordan this weekend with US planes shooting down Iranian missiles. It's coming perilously close to that, surely.
Yes, and that's why I think that the Iranian response was a mistake for Iran's part. But I think that when we talk about Israel's April 1st strike, I don't think Israel expected this response from Iran. I think that maybe had they known ahead of time that this would happen, they would have done it anyway. But I think that they were taken by surprise over the subsequent 2 weeks when all of a sudden you had these warnings, particularly in the second half of last week, that Iran was going to respond with real force and warnings that, you know, missiles and rockets were coming within 24 hours. I don't think that Israel expected that to be the result when they struck at the Iranian site. Again, because this sort of shadow war that's played out mostly in Syria and Lebanon has been going on now for years.
And also, the Iranians, when there was the general a couple of years ago who was killed by Israel, and then going back, I forget exactly when, the Iranian nuclear reactor was destroyed by the Israeli Air Force, and there wasn't an overt response from Iran in those two key instances. So I suppose you could say the Iranians, they suck it up and
don't do anything overt. Of course, they have their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, and they will lob rockets into northern or southern Israel. Did Israel just think, we can do this, the Iranians never respond because they haven't in the previous other instances?
I think that the Israelis probably assumed that the Iranians would respond in ways that they have in the past, either using proxies to shoot missiles by the Golan Heights or having the Houthis shoot missiles towards southern Israel into a lot. I don't think they expected something like this coming directly from Iran and directly from Iranian territory.
What has been the reaction of the Israeli populace to the, firstly, let's say, to the Israeli attack in Syria, and then to the response of Iran?
Israel's attack in Syria wasn't a huge deal inside of Israel in terms of people paying close attention, again, because this tit-for-tat has been a normal thing now for years. I think that it actually got on most Israelis' radar once you had the warnings that Iran was going to respond. Then all of a sudden last week, Israelis were going to the supermarket and buying generators and stocking up on things because there were reports that a big response was coming. But I don't think in the moment most Israelis were paying attention to the strike itself. When the Iranian response came, you had this strange scene where Israelis were, they got the warnings, things had been launched, and they had 5 or 6 hours to sit around and wait. And then hours later, air raid sirens went off and people went into shelters. And across social media, people may have seen videos that Israelis posted of what looked like fireworks displays in the sky, where you had various interceptors taking down some of the projectiles. Most of the things in those videos are actually Arrow 3 interceptors against ballistic missiles. So they took place in outer space, beyond the atmosphere. And then a lot of those flashes were things falling back into the atmosphere. So this took place at very high altitude, and a lot of the things were intercepted, particularly the drones and cruise missiles, over Jordanian and Iraqi airspace by the U.S. and by the U.K. and by others. So far, there's only been one reported injury inside of Israel as a result. There was an Israeli Bedouin who was injured from falling shrapnel, but so far that's it. And I think it was a strange and I think for many people scary experience, especially seeing how many things came over. But almost immediately after, the Israeli Home Front Command told Israelis they didn't have to be by bomb shelters. Airspace is back open. Flights are coming in and out of Ben Gurion Airport. But at least for now, Israelis seem to have gone back to normal. And I think that everybody is now waiting to see how Israel responds and whether that is going to dictate another Iranian response to whatever Israel does.
I don't think there's going to be another Iranian response unless there is an Israeli one. We saw the scenes in the news about the triumphalism in Iranian media and in the Iranian parliament. I think they think job's done. This is almost symbolic. And surely, you know, when you say, not you, but when we look at the fact that 300 missiles came over, the Iranians aren't stupid. They know there is the Iron Dome. They also appreciate there's going to be some level of help from the US Air Force in terms of shooting these things down. They had to send over 300 plus just to get the 1% which actually landed anywhere of any level of significance, because Israel is so well defended in terms of air defense, etc. But I want to come back to this idea of maybe widening the conflict, because as a political aim, that seems to me pretty much a goal of Israel, which would make a lot of sense, to maybe move focus from Hamas to we are under existential threat, to provoke Hezbollah and Iran so that this isn't a case of what's happening in Gaza. This is a case of the state of Israel is under its most existential threat, let's say, since 1967 or 1948. And in that way, this surely does play into whether it's Netanyahu or some of those more far-right wing elements of Israeli politics.
That may end up being a byproduct. I don't think that's actually what Israel was up to with its strike in Damascus. Especially because the guy that they killed was the head of the rocket unit for Syria and Lebanon, and this is somebody that's been on Israel radar for a long time. It wasn't a random guy who happened to be there. But Iran's response, of course, has indeed shifted the narrative away from Gaza and has highlighted the Iranian threat against Israel and the Iranian regional threat and the cooperation between the U.S., other NATO allies, and the regional states with Israel against Iran, which is why I think that Iran made a mistake in its response. And I think now Netanyahu has a choice, right? Choice one is to widen this further and use this as an opportunity to strike at Iran much harder, maybe even to strike at Iran's nuclear facilities, which may further some Israeli military and strategic goals, but without question will cause Israel enormous diplomatic problems and will shift the narrative from Israel being under attack from Iran and having all of these various allies marshal a response together to Israel being the more aggressive party. That's one possibility. The other possibility, and this is the one that I would take if I were Prime Minister Netanyahu, is to take advantage of the fact that now people are focused on the Iranian threat and are less focused on Gaza and less focused on Israeli actions, and use that to do two things. The first thing is to figure out a way to conclude the fighting in Gaza and get to the day after, take this as an opportunity to reset. And the second is to build upon this enormous success that we saw on Saturday night and early Sunday morning, because the whole theory behind Israel wanting to normalize relations in the region, aside from, of course, not wanting to be diplomatically isolated, is this notion that you can build a wide regional coalition to contain Iran, and that rather than have Israel be isolated, you can turn the tables and have Iran be isolated. And this was demonstrated to enormously successful effect in a way that we have never seen before. This wasn't just Israeli air defenses and American and British planes. Various reports about the extent to which the Jordanians and the Emiratis and the Saudis contributed, whether there were actually Jordanian planes flying or whether it was just a matter of intelligence. But these countries all pitched in a seamless, coordinated way. And this is supposed to be the dream of regional normalization, not only for Israel, but for the United States, that wants to create this network of partners and allies and take some of the burden off the U.S. to do the heavy lifting in the Middle East. And so if you are Netanyahu, you can use this as an opportunity to keep on building in this direction. But striking at Iran in a hard way is going to make that far more difficult. I honestly don't know what Netanyahu is going to choose, path one or path two. There are many hawkish folks in the Israeli government who want path one. It isn't only Netanyahu. It was reported in the Israeli press today that Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, two of the people who are seen as more responsible, who joined the government just in an emergency capacity, that they were urging on Saturday night for an immediate response against Iran, one that ultimately did not come, I think probably because President Biden talked Prime Minister Netanyahu down off the ledge. There are a lot of folks pushing for a stronger response. The U.S. is very clearly pushing for Israel to, as was reported in President Biden's words, take this as a win and not escalate further. I don't have a great sense yet of what Israel is going to do, but I absolutely think that path number two is the smarter path.
I must admit, this is like threading the eye of a needle whilst trying to find something. I'm lost on the metaphors here. It's like threading the eye of the needle whilst trying to find a needle in a haystack in terms of.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Trying to marshal Sunni Muslim support, which is popular support, not just the support of the ruling elites, the ruling monarchs, who are implacably against a Shia Iran. And the position of a country like Jordan is so on a knife edge here. We know there's been a groundswell of support for the Palestinians in somewhere like Jordan. And Jordan has a whole history around the PLO and taking them in, expelling them in the early 1970s, etc., which has put the whole edifice of the Jordanian state most definitely on somewhat of a precipice historically. Anyway, let's move this subtly into Israeli internal politics. And one of the things I did want to talk to you about, and this, and extensively, that's initially when I booked you to come in, was really to talk about internal Israeli politics. And let's start with the call to end the long-standing draft exemptions for the ultra-Orthodox community and how that is playing out in terms of the various strands of Israeli society.
There is a big division between the ultra-Orthodox and between the other part, mainly the secular part, who takes the burden of taxpaying, serving in the military, and all the other duties that every citizen has.
Boaz Arad is a retired lawyer. Like most Israelis, he served in the military. He says it's not fair that a growing population of ultra-Orthodox don't have the same responsibilities as everyone else, and that people like him have to pay for them.
They want to keep the situation as it is because it's very comfortable for them. They don't have to endanger their lives for the security of this country. But
the ultra-Orthodox, or Haredim, make up just over 13% of Israel's population. Government projections suggest that will rise to more than 30% by 2065.
As I understand it, at the birth of the State of Israel, ultra-Orthodox Jews or Haredi Jews, the Haredi community, was exempt from going into the military. At that point, they were a tiny minority. Now, some 70 plus years later, we're talking about 66,000 Israeli citizens who are exempt from going into the military. And I know when I went to Israel, in my friend who served in the IDF said very clearly, I am upset by this. This is wrong because they don't put their necks on the line in the way that our secular Jews do. And so there's this long-running fault line in Israeli society. How is that playing out now, considering the war which Israel is conducted in Gaza? And then how is that playing out politically with this new draft law?
The issue has come really to a head because of the war in Gaza, as you note. There was a point where you had over 200,000 and close to 300,000 Israeli reservists who were called up to go either south to Gaza or north to the border with Lebanon. And it made this issue of the talk about in Israel, the phrase they use is a quality of the burden of service. It made this issue really personal for many people in a way that it maybe wasn't before. And so you have this just groundswell of opinion right now, overwhelming, that says the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, can no longer get away with getting subsidies for yeshivot, for religious schools, and tax breaks and services, unless they're going to serve in some way. And there are some elements within the ultra-Orthodox community that have said, sure, we have to do a better job of pitching in, and maybe it won't necessarily be in the IDF. Maybe it will be national service, serve in border police units, or serve in EMS services. But from what we can see, the majority, at least of the leadership of the ultra-Orthodox community, has taken a pretty hard line against this. And there have recently been ultra-Orthodox protests and rallies where they literally say, we will leave the country or we will die before going and serving in the IDF. And part of it has to do with the fact that they do indeed want to be in yeshivot, in religious schools, and they genuinely believe that they are performing as big a service for Israel as the IDF is, because they believe that if they were not learning Torah all day in religious schools, that Israel would collapse and would be under threat, and that God would literally abandon Israel. But part of it is that the Orthodox community, they used to be anti-Zionist. Now I would say that they are non-Zionist. And what I mean by that is that they're willing, of course, to live in the land of Israel, and they're willing to nominally accept the authority of the state of Israel, but they believe the state is illegitimate. They believe that until the Messiah comes and establishes a religious kingdom in Israel, that the secular state of Israel is not a legitimate entity. And so they actually have a deep religious and philosophical objection to serving in the IDF, because they say this is not a legitimate army, and it's not a legitimate institution, and it's not even a legitimate state. It isn't just about are we going to sit all day and learn Torah. It's also about how they view the legitimacy of the state and its institutions.
Michael, thank you for giving me a teachable moment, as the Americans would say there, because I presumed, shall we say, that they would be ultra-Zionist. And I know there is some element of ultra-Orthodox Jewish belief which believes that the state of Israel is illegitimate. I was aware of that. I didn't realize it was such a large part of this conundrum here within the state of Israel. So I wasn't aware of that. However, where does this put, let's say, your Smotriches and your Ben-Gavirs in terms of their support for that community and their bellicose nationalism and their Zionism? Try and triangulate that.
Yes, so this is where things get particularly interesting. So you have the ultra-Orthodox and you have the religious Zionist Orthodox. The ultra-Orthodox are the ones that we have been talking about. Then you have the religious Zionist Orthodox, represented by Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. And that segment of Orthodox Israelis, they're not the most Zionist, but they are indeed ultra-Zionists. They actually serve in the IDF in combat units at a higher percentage than any other demographic inside of Israel. And unlike the ultra-Orthodox, who believe that the state of Israel is illegitimate, the religious Zionist Orthodox movement believes that the state of Israel actually is, the phrase in Hebrew is reshit tzmichat ulateinu, the beginning of the flowering of redemption, meaning they believe that the state of Israel's existence actually heralds the coming of the Messiah, whereas the ultra-Orthodox say this is not a sign of anything. Until the Messiah actually comes, the state is illegitimate. So you have this deep difference between these two segments of the Orthodox community. The ultra-Orthodox and the religious Zionists tend generally to be in agreement over many things. They're both right-wing politically. They both serve under right-wing governments. They've both been real allies of Prime Minister Netanyahu. But because this issue of burden of service, particularly since October 7th, is such a burning one inside of Israel, you've had Smotrich and Ben-Gvir come out and say publicly, these draft exemptions cannot continue for the ultra-Orthodox. Even though they are in many ways our political allies, this is unacceptable and they have to be drafted. And where things stand now is that there was this April 1st deadline set by the Supreme Court, whereby there had to be a draft law. And if there wasn't, then ultra-Orthodox would get draft notices. And just to pick up on something you said earlier, when this arrangement was first concluded between Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, and ultra-Orthodox leaders, back in the late 1940s, the number, I think, is there were maybe 400 ultra-Orthodox of draft age who were not drafted. The number, as it stands today, are 66,000. This is just exponentially mushroomed. And there was this April 1st deadline. If there was no draft law, then they were supposed to get draft notices and the budgets to their yeshiva were supposed to be cut off. The government, there was no agreement by April 1st. The government went back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court gave until April 30th. And so they're still behind the scenes working furiously to figure out if they can get a draft law that will establish new quotas for ultra-Orthodox, for the ultra-Orthodox draft, and have some sort of penalties if they don't meet them. Open question as to whether they'll be able to do it. Part of the difficulty is that the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that he will only support a bill that has the support of Benny Gantz as well. And so if you have a deal that's worked out between Netanyahu and the ultra-Orthodox parties, that doesn't necessarily get Benny Gantz or even Yoav Gallant on board. And you also now have this issue of the Iranian strike on Israel. And my guess is the government will try to use that to argue that there should be another extension. So unclear how this is going to play out, but there is this April 30th deadline that's out there looming.
Well, one of the things which Benny Gantz, who's the defense minister, has also mentioned is that Arab citizens of Israel participate more actively in service roles. How has that call gone down with your Smotrichs and your Ben-Gvirs, but also with the Israeli Arab community?
Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, obviously, not only do they not care if the Arab community serves, I think they actually prefer to have them not serve. Ben-Gvir in particular would say that they're a fifth column inside of Israel and you can't trust them. You can't trust them in the IDF or in service. I think that many Israelis, when they look at this issue of equality of burden of service, they tend to be angrier at the ultra-Orthodox because the ultra-Orthodox get huge government subsidies. And so it isn't just a matter of not serving. It's also a matter of subsidies and tax breaks and all sorts of benefits. But I think most Israelis want to see this extended to the ultra-Orthodox and to Israeli Arabs and say, there's got to be something that you can do, right? Whether it's serve the IDF or perform national service, you need to be contributing in some way. That is far and away the most popular move. And when Benny Gantz talks about this, having to go not just to the ultra-Orthodox community, but to the Israeli Arab community as well, I think he's reflecting this popular sentiment. It is important to note that there is one segment of the Arab community that serves at high rates, actually, I think even higher rates than any other than Israeli Jews, which are the Druze. When they serve at high rates, they're in all sorts of high-ranking officer positions, up to and including major generals. The Druze pitch in more than anybody else.
Why is that, Michael? I was really struck when I went to northern Israel, around Galilee, and those Druze communities, and you saw the Star of David. Why is it that community is so aligned with serving in the Israeli military?
So I'll say this with the caveat that I'm certainly not an expert on the Druze, but my understanding is that part of Druze religion and heritage and tradition is that you are completely loyal to whatever state you live in. So you have this funny situation where there are Druze communities in northern Israel and on the Golan Heights, and then there are Druze communities in Syria, also on the Golan Heights, that were under, before 1967, under Syrian rule. And then after 1967 in the Six-Day War, when the Golan Heights was split, you had some on one side of the border and some on the other side of the border. And wherever they are completely loyal to the state that has sovereignty over them. And the Druze on the Israeli side, both the ones who were in the Galilee before, and so were always in the state of Israel, and those who found themselves in the state of Israel from 1967 onwards, they're loyal to Israel and they serve in the military, and the ones on the Syrian side presumably do the same thing. And when Israel passed its nation state law in 2018, which was passed as a basic law, and said that it didn't actually make any policy changes, but it said that as a group, only Jews have the right to national self-determination in the land of Israel, it caused a huge uproar with Druze because they said, how can you possibly leave us out of this? We are loyal citizens and we serve in the army and we contribute and die alongside Israeli Jews. And actually, since 2018, this has become a real issue where some people who actually supported the nation state law in 2018, who are on the right side of the political spectrum, say, you know what, that was a mistake because we left the Druze out. And so the Druze really do stand out as an exception in all of this.
In 2018, Israel enacted a significant and controversial piece of legislation, the Basic Law, Israel as the Nation State of the Jewish People, commonly referred to as the Nation State Law. This law affirms that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and specifies that the right to national self-determination within Israel is unique to the Jewish people. Key elements of the law include the establishment of Hebrew as the official language, relegating Arabic to a special status, but still maintaining its use in official capacities. The law also reinforces Jewish symbols, such as the national anthem, flag, and emblem, deeply rooted in Jewish culture. Additionally, it supports the development and consolidation of Jewish settlements, a measure that has stirred international controversy, particularly concerning the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This law has sparked a wide range of reactions, reflecting its profound implications for Israel's social, cultural, and political fabric.
There has been some level of a tactical realignment of Israeli military force in Gaza. We're still somewhat confused as to whether this is a redeployment or a strategic withdrawal, and that Israel isn't going to go in, dare I say, all guns ablazing in Rafah. This realignment has meant that in Khan Yunis, for example, that Gazans, Palestinians have been able to go back into that city for what that is worth, considering the level of devastation which has gone there. People have been told they can go back to their homes, and there literally are no homes to go to. This does start to pose the question as much more of an immediate thing. What happens post this conflict? What is the Israeli government going to do? Has there been any level of debate about what will happen in Gaza post the kinetic element of the conflict?
There certainly has been debate, and the debate has been, do you get some sort of Palestinian Authority presence back into Gaza or not? Because while Israel's military campaign has been largely successful at disrupting Hamas's military capabilities, what we're already seeing is that when Israel leaves an area, it creates a vacuum, and Hamas comes to fill that vacuum. And so we've now seen it already in northern Gaza in a number of ways, whether it be Israel going back into Shifa Hospital after it had conducted one major operation and then having to go back and conduct a second major operation, or whether it's masked Hamas fighters with clubs who are patrolling markets in northern Gaza and basically keeping law and order, or whether it's reports of Hamas fighters going back into Khan Yunis as soon as Israel left the area, vacuums get filled. And so far, Hamas has been filling the vacuum. And Prime Minister Netanyahu's position has been that the Palestinian Authority is just as bad as Hamas, and so you can't have them go back into Gaza, whereas many other folks in Israel, certainly in the opposition, but even folks in the war cabinet like Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot have said, this is a mistake. We should figure out how to get some sort of PA element back into Gaza as a way of filling the vacuum. So far, Netanyahu has not really budged, and so the plan has basically been to have no plan. And I think that there's a wide range of possible outcomes here, everything from a full Israeli occupation where Israel has to do everything, from a plan that brings the PA in and then probably gets some help from outside Arab states, to continuing along the path that Israel has gone on so far, which is to do nothing and then really risk Hamas returning. And we were talking earlier about the aftermath of the Iranian strike and what Israel is going to do. To me, this is one of the opportunities that is now out there to seize upon the change of narrative and try to have a more productive policy for what happens in Gaza once Israel's military operation is over.
Michael Kaplow, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic again. We're going to need to have our own hotline, you and I, just like the ones between the US and the Soviet Union in the dim days of the Cold War, because I think there's going to be many more twists and turns before we have any idea of how this conflict is going to play out. Can we institute such a thing, sir, between me in Birmingham in England and you in Washington, D.C.?
Sure, we'll get a red cross.
Absolutely. Michael, again, thank you for coming on, and thank you for being informed, balanced, and measured in your commentary. And thank you for teaching me a thing or two about internal Israeli politics, which I genuinely did not know. What you can do, dear listener, is post on the Substack your comments to this episode. One of the things which we are going to institute at the end of every month is a compendium of some of your best comments into another episode of the podcast, which is your right to reply. So you can either do it on the Substack, which is royfield.substack.com, and post your comments there. And if you are listening to the podcast, and there's a good few thousand of you that download the podcast each episode, please sign up to the Substack. It's something new for me, considering I've been doing this podcast for this is my 11th year, but it's a way of building community, which is something which we haven't done before. Also, what you can do if you do want to hear your voice on the podcast is go to WhatsApp, which is +447 957 167696. Post a voice note there, and we'll also put that in the companion shows. That's WhatsApp, which is +447 957 167696. Be really good to build a real sense of community, a global community around these issues, if you did that. Also, another thing which you can do to help out the podcast is to go on to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and please post a review. That is the best and the most effective way for us to get new listeners onto the podcast. Michael, considering you have to sit through me say all of that, why don't you tell people where they can find you online and also the work of the Israel Policy Forum?
Yeah, you can find my work and the work of my incredible, talented, amazing colleagues at israelpolicyforum.org. I write a column that we send out every single Thursday So if you go to the website, you can sign up for that. We also, I hesitate to promote a different podcast on your podcast.
But we have our own podcast. You're going to do it anyway. I can feel it. Go on.
We have our own podcast as well called Israel Policy Pod. So if you're interested in Israel issues, I'd suggest you take a listen to that. And yeah, thanks for having me, Roy Fell. It's always a pleasure.
Will we get a little, maybe get a little bit of a mention on that podcast then?
So I can talk to our host, Neri Zilber, who does it, but that's out of my hands, unfortunately.
You know what? Here you go. You've got people, right? You've got a whole team of people beyond it. I've just got me. But anyway, such is the difference between the size of our two organizations. I'm a one-man band and yours is somewhat of an organization. Michael Caplow, thank you for coming on to Mid-Atlantic. And we'll hear from you soon, no doubt. So there you go, good people. Say at the end of every episode, left your center policies is right thinking politics. Let's hope that left-leaning people in the state of Israel realize that you cannot bomb and eradicate an idea by military means, that ultimately what they're doing in Gaza is recruiting more soldiers, ideological and physical soldiers, for Hamas, which is an organization which, though I don't support, I understand at least their desire to want a Palestinian homeland. So let's hope that left-leaning Israelis will be able to put pressure on Netanyahu and the current government in Israel and persuade enough Israelis that a two-state solution is the only solution so the two peoples can live in some level of relative peace together. Take care, look after yourselves. Bye-bye.